From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the hidden story of America's space espionage. We talk with journalist Philip Taubman about his new book, Secret Empire. It describes how America developed U-2 reconnaissance planes and satellite spy technology during the Cold War. We still use this technology today, but our reliance on it helped leave us unprepared for terrorism. Taubman is the deputy editorial page editor of the New York Times. We'll also talk with him about writing editorials related to Iraq. The annual South by Southwest Music Conference is now underway in Austin, Texas. Our rock historian Ed Ward will revisit the early days of the Austin alternative music scene. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration now says it might accept a delay in a vote on a UN resolution that would authorize war against Iraq, or even that it may not call for a vote at all. A vote a week ago, President Bush said that he would insist on a vote that would force members of the Security Council to take a stand on Iraqi disarmament. Although U.S. diplomats have worked hard to win the support of at least 9 of the Council's 15 members, it appears that the administration may not have enough votes to claim at least a moral victory on the issue. Spokesman Ari Fleischer says the White House is prepared to postpone a vote until next week, and Secretary of State Colin Powell said the U.S. may go ahead without a vote. The diplomatic stalemate over war with Iraq has led to a British war of words with France, which has vowed to veto any resolution that calls for an attack against Iraq. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from London.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair let it be known that a second UN resolution was now probably less likely than at any time. Shortly later, Foreign Secretary Jack Straw slammed France for refusing even to consider a British proposal for 6 disarmament conditions for Saddam Hussein. And the Prime Minister's spokesman criticized France for rejecting Britain's proposals even before Iraq did. Opinion polls show that a large majority of Britons don't approve going to war without UN backing. But Blair has vowed that British troops will join U.S. forces in combat. The British media, however, continues to raise the question whether a war with Iraq, not authorized by the United Nations, would violate international law. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, London.
The House of Representatives has voted to limit how much juries can award patients for pain and suffering in medical malpractice cases. NPR's Patricia Naimond reports.
The legislation would limit awards for non-economic damages. That includes pain and suffering for injuries like the loss of sight or a limb. It does not limit how much juries can award patients to cover medical costs or wages lost as a result of not working. The House follows the lead of California and a number of other states with similar caps. These caps are highly controversial, and opponents argue they will not help curb rising malpractice costs. Doctors and insurance companies say that malpractice premiums are skyrocketing due to an increase in frivolous lawsuits and multi-million-dollar jury awards. These high premiums have caused many doctors to stop practicing medicine. The bill now goes to the Senate, where it's expected to face stronger opposition. Patricia Naimond, NPR News.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 269 points, or more than 3.5%, to close at 7,821 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 61 points, close to 5%, to close at 1,340. This is NPR News. The recovery of abducted teenager Elizabeth Smart near Salt Lake City has given new energy to efforts to pass so-called Amber Alert legislation in Congress. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
A national Amber Alert system would activate large, bright road signs and other mass media anytime a child goes missing to put citizens on the lookout. Virtually every lawmaker supports the legislation. The problem, according to Texas Democrat Martin Frost, is that the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Wisconsin Republican James Sensenbrenner, has muddied up the original bill.
Our legislation is bipartisan, and it has already passed the Senate unanimously twice. It was overwhelming. It has overwhelming support in the House. It would be the law of the land today, except that it is caught up in Chairman Sensenbrenner's much more complicated and controversial bill.
Sensenbrenner contends the Amber Alert proposal is better off as part of a large package of child protection laws. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, the Capitol.
A policeman who helped recover Elizabeth Smart yesterday says the girl was unwilling to admit who she was right away. The 15-year-old was accompanied by an itinerant preacher and his wife, and she was disguised with a wig. Officer Troy Rasperson said she at first appeared angry at his questions.
When I just kind of called their bluff and said, no, you know, Elizabeth, you need to come clean on this, it was like maybe a sigh of relief.
Elizabeth's father said he believes she was brainwashed by her captors, who apparently kept her with them since she was abducted last June. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 27 points to close at 831. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, embracing the diversity of more than 100,000 employees and the people they serve, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the ways that UN weapons inspectors have gathered intelligence about Iraq is through U-2 reconnaissance planes. These high-flying spy planes were developed during the Cold War under the Eisenhower administration. My guest Philip Taubman has written a new book about how Eisenhower and the CIA secretly developed the U-2 and satellite spy technology. The book is called Secret Empire, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Hidden Story of America's Space Espionage. Taubman is the deputy editorial page editor of the New York Times. We'll discuss the Times editorials about Iraq a little later. He covered national security and intelligence issues for more than 20 years, was the Times Moscow bureau chief in the late 80s, and directed the Washington Bureau's coverage of the Gulf War in the early 90s. I asked Philip Taubman why he wanted to write about Eisenhower, the CIA, and the space technology they developed.
We were faced with a threat in the 1950s that is somewhat similar to the threat that we face today, in the sense that there was a new emerging danger in the world. In the 1950s, it was the Soviet Union. Today, it's obviously terrorism. And I wanted to go back and look at the way another administration had tackled a threat at a time when we were essentially blind to the forces that the Soviet Union had. We knew that they were a rising power, that they had come out of World War II as our ally, and then shortly thereafter the Cold War had begun to develop. And as I covered intelligence over the years for the New York Times, I became aware that during the Eisenhower administration there had been a series of technological breakthroughs in spying that allowed us to overcome that blindness and allowed us to avoid one of the great concerns that Eisenhower himself had, which was that the United States, through fear of the unknown, would become what he called a garrison state, meaning that we would pour so much of our wealth into defense that we would cripple ourselves economically.
What inspired Eisenhower to pursue new spy technology?
Well, you know, he came up through the Army, of course. He was a graduate of West Point, where he had studied engineering. And then as the supreme Allied commander in Europe during World War II, he learned firsthand about the advantages of technology. There were breakthroughs during the war that changed the course of the war, the development of radar, for example, the cracking of the Nazi coding system. And ultimately, in the Pacific theater, the development and use of atomic weapons, which ended the war in Japan. So after the war, Eisenhower had a great appreciation for the potential advantages of technology. And he'd also learned during the war, particularly in the last months of the war in Europe, that you could be surprised still by German military activities because you didn't have adequate intelligence. So he came into his presidency as someone who was open to new ideas.
You describe him as having pursued a unique partnership between science and industry and the military in order to develop this new spy technology. What was his approach of creating a kind of open, creative atmosphere for these people to work in.
You know, it's interesting when you look back at the course of American history, I think there are really two presidents who stand out as having an abiding faith in science. The first one was Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, was a scientist himself, and the other was Dwight Eisenhower. And when he moved into the White House after a period in which he'd been president of Columbia University, he came in already with associations in the scientific community. And he'd also, in service after the war, briefly serving as chief of staff of the Army, had given the Army in those first months and years after the war a mandate to go out and do technological research unburdened by conventional thinking. So after his inauguration in January of 1953, he began to reach out to scientists, and before long, he brought into the White House on a regular basis a group of outside advisors, and over the course of his presidency, his reliance on them increased to a point where they were really among the most valuable advisors he had, and I think it's safe to say that no president since then, with the possible exception of Kennedy, has made as much and as valuable use of science advisors as Eisenhower did.
One of the most successful technological innovations during the Eisenhower administration was the U-2 spy plane, a high-flying reconnaissance plane. What was this plane able to do that hadn't been done before?
Fly deep into the Soviet Union. Up until the time of the development of the U-2 in 1955-56, we were pretty much restricted to flights in conventional planes along the frontiers of the Soviet Union, where you really only could get a kind of oblique look at what was going on. And then, actually, sounds harebrained, but we did it for a while. We would send helium-filled balloons with cameras strapped to them over the Soviet Union, and the idea was that they would get into the jet stream, fly over the Soviet Union, take pictures, and then when they emerged on the other side over the Pacific coast, they would be recovered by American aircraft. Well, not surprisingly, most of them were either blown down or shot down over the Soviet Union. And as time went on in the early 50s, Eisenhower became increasingly desperate to learn about Soviet weaponry. And actually, under President Truman, some flights into the interior of the Soviet Union began. And of course, not surprisingly, pilots were shot down, planes were destroyed. This was a secret chapter of the Cold War that only emerged in the 1980s. And when it did, we discovered that the United States had lost well over 200 airmen in flights either on the periphery or over the heart of the Soviet Union. So the U-2 was created essentially in the hope of developing an invulnerable or at least less vulnerable aircraft that could fly over the heart of the Soviet Union, look down at military and industrial sites, and escape unscathed.
How high could it fly, and how did that help it escape unscathed?
It was quite a revolutionary aircraft in its day. If you turn the clock back and go back to 1954-55, man had never flown for sustained periods at the altitude of 60, 70, 80,000 feet. There'd been some test flights at that altitude in rocket planes, but they lasted very briefly. So when Kelly Johnson, who was this wonderfully gifted aircraft designer at the Lockheed Company out in California, started to design a new spy plane, he had enormous obstacles to overcome. The airplane itself had to operate for hours at that altitude. That meant that new fuels had to be created, a new kind of airplane had to be designed. Pilots had to have pressure suits so that if there was some kind of explosive decompression in the cockpit, they would be able to survive long enough to bring the aircraft down. There was just a series of breakthroughs in development of that plane that make it still valuable today. It's still being used 50 years later to monitor activities in Iraq.
The U-2 started being used as a spy plane during the Cold War, so we were officially in peacetime. What were some of the political issues that we had to deal with using these spy planes during peace, not during war?
There were huge political issues, and in fact, they were so important and intimidating that they gave Eisenhower pause over and over again about using the plane. The formula is really quite simple. If it's peacetime, if you're not engaged in a war, the sending of a spy plane over the territory, the sovereign airspace of another country, is essentially an act of war. And Eisenhower told his colleagues at one point during this period when the U-2 was in use that if the Soviet Union had developed a similar plane and was penetrating American airspace as brazenly as the United States was flying into Soviet airspace, it would prompt him to go immediately to Congress to seek a declaration of war.
But the Soviets didn't do that.
Soviets, fortunately, didn't have the technology, didn't have that kind of aircraft. And when the U-2 began to fly over the Soviet Union in July of 1956, they couldn't knock it down. They barely could track it, though they could track it. I think to avoid international humiliation, they never conceded publicly that their airspace was being so egregiously violated over the course of the next 4 years.
My guest is Philip Taubman, deputy editorial page editor of the New York Times and author of the new book Secret Empire, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Hidden Story of America's Space Espionage. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Philip Taubman. He's the author of the new book, Secret Empire, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Hidden Story of America's Space Espionage. He's also deputy editor of the New York Times editorial page. Let's look at satellite technology. We've discussed the U-2 spy plane. What were the hopes for satellite technology when it was in its formative stages during the Eisenhower years?
The first plan for this actually was too far ahead of its time. The whole concept of putting a satellite or an observation post into space was a kind of over-the-horizon idea. It was almost science fiction at the time the RAND Corporation out in Santa Monica began to proselytize for this. Don't forget, we had not put any kind of object into space at this time, and in fact, it was not until 1957 that the Soviet Union first put a satellite into orbit, and that one, Sputnik 1, was not a spy satellite. So when you begin to find the thread of this story back in the 1940s, we're really talking in a kind of fantasy world about what might be done if you could put cameras in space. So you had to develop the rocketry to do it, you had to develop the satellite vehicle, you had to develop phenomenally acute cameras, the kind of cameras that are used on the U-2. It's basically child's play compared to the cameras that would be required to shoot pictures from 100, 200 miles out in space and see anything on the ground that would be helpful. The first technology that the RAND people recommended was to take pictures with a camera in a satellite, then scan them, and then take those images and electronically relay them back down to Earth where they could then be assembled and shown to people. That, in fact, is a kind of shorthand for the very advanced technology that we use today in satellites, digital technology. But back in the 1950s, this was just beyond the reach of American science. And it was only when Edwin Land and Jim Killian, Eisenhower's science advisors, took a look at the satellite program and said, wait a minute, you're trying to do too much. This is too complicated. Let's go to a simpler concept. It was only then that we made the breakthrough that allowed us to create a workable system.
Every country has sovereign control of its airspace, and if you violate that, it's can be considered an act of war. What about the protocol for space technology, where you can't necessarily even see if it's over your country and taking pictures of your country?
That was an issue much debated at the time. It was almost as new in legal terms as the technologies that were being developed were in scientific terms. Since there'd never been objects in space, no one really knew what the law of space was. And there was great fear in the Eisenhower administration that the Soviet Union would claim that if the United States has a satellite that's passing over the Soviet Union, that it's somehow violating sovereign Soviet airspace. So there was a lot of discussion about that. The issue was essentially eliminated by the Russians themselves, because in that case, they solved the problem for us by putting up the first satellite in October 1957. And, of course, at that point, they were happy to have it circling over all kinds of countries and had no objection about the fact that there was such a thing. So that opened the way for us to put up satellites without incurring the wrath of the Russians.
Has any law actually ever been written defining the sovereignty of airspace and the use of satellites?
Yes, the UN eventually adopted a law of space which essentially guarantees the freedom of space, and that's why space has become such an important frontier for us militarily, because we basically have the freedom to put up as many military satellites as we want, and our military has become incredibly dependent on satellites for everything from communications to guidance of weapon systems to movement of troops. The gathering of intelligence is now just one of many facets of American military power that is basically dependent on satellites.
Eisenhower was worried about the growing power of what he described as the military-industrial complex, and he said the munition makers are making tremendous efforts toward getting more contracts and, in fact, seeming to exert undue influence over the senators. What were his concerns about the military-industrial complex?
They were quite profound, and they led to his description, the use of that term, the military-industrial complex, in his farewell address to the nation shortly before he left office. And it's particularly interesting to think back that these words and these concerns came from someone who was imbued with the military culture, who had grown up in the military and had been a hero as an army general.
And in fact, he helped create that military-industrial complex.
He did, but he created it with the expectation that it would be manageable, that it would not, in effect, take on a life of its own, where the sort of politics between the industrial companies and the Congress and the Pentagon would create a kind of environment where weapon systems were being built because they were creating jobs, where weapon systems were being built because they were boosting corporate profits, where this whole thing became like some kind of nuclear chain reaction, where it essentially took on a life beyond the control of the White House and policymakers in Washington. And Eisenhower was acutely concerned about a society in which so much money was spent on weapons that the economy would suffer, that the nature of American civilization would suffer, because we would become essentially an armed camp. And he was worried, as he came to the end of his term in the White House, that this nexus between the government and industry that he had actually done so much to foster had essentially gotten out of control.
Do you think there's also more of a revolving door today between people in politics and the defense industry? In other words, politicians going back and forth between politics and the defense industry.
There's certainly much more of that than there was, although interestingly, I found in my research that there were kind of precursor examples of things going on which today would be frowned upon and which seem to be accepted back in the 1950s. They're small cases, but they're interesting to me because, as I say, they were a preview of things to come where there would be someone working at the Pentagon who'd come out of private industry, out of a military contractor, and while that person was working at the Pentagon, he was promoting projects that would bring money to the firm that he had left before he came to Washington. It didn't lead to the kind of scandals that we have today, although there was an Air Force secretary at the time, Harold Talbot, who got caught in an ethical problem and essentially had to give up his job. But you could see the beginnings of what you're talking about.
Are there people in the administration or in Congress today who've walked through that particular revolving door?
Well, indeed. You can begin with Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, who came out of industry. He's been back and forth over time. There are just dozens of people when you look around the governmental agencies. And it's not to say that it's necessarily has to be problematic. I mean, the expertise that one develops working on satellite programs, for example, in the private sector, may make someone particularly well qualified to run the satellite programs in the American government. The problem develops if people lose track of the importance of separating their industrial interests that they might have had earlier in their career with their governmental interests, and then once they leave government, failing to make the distinction as they go back to the private sector. But you can look at a lot of jobs. The director of the National Reconnaissance Office, Director Teets, for example, was at Lockheed for many years. So there's a lot of moving back and forth. As I say, it's not, by definition, a bad thing. It just depends on how individuals handle it.
Dick Cheney, who used to be the head of Halliburton, one of its subsidiaries, Brown & Root, is a private military corporation which has gotten huge contracts and even contracts relating to war with Iraq.
Well, I think one of the things the Bush administration has to be exceedingly careful about is that whatever comes to pass in Iraq, that we don't end up looking as though this was done to advance the corporate interests of entities like Halliburton. I think it would just be a terrible mistake if we were to end up in a situation where we controlled the Iraqi oil fields and then all of a sudden, my goodness, Halliburton, Dick Cheney's former company, has a multi-billion dollar contract to go in and manage the Iraqi oil fields. I think that would just confirm for many people their worst suspicions about the Bush administration.
Philip Taubman is the author of the new book Secret Empire, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Hidden Story of America's Space Espionage. He's also deputy editorial page editor of the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Harcourt, publisher of The Ticket Out, Helen Knode's debut crime novel, a noir mystery set in Hollywood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Philip Taubman and talk about publishing editorials that take a stand on war with Iraq. He's the deputy editorial page editor of the New York Times. And Ed Ward looks back at the early days of Austin's alternative music scene. The South by Southwest Music Conference is now underway in Austin.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Philip Taubman, author of the new book Secret Empire, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Hidden Story of America's Space Espionage. Taubman covered national security and intelligence issues for more than 20 years, served as the New York Times Moscow bureau chief in the late 80s, and directed the Washington Bureau's coverage of the Gulf War in the early 90s. Your position now at the New York Times is you're deputy editor of the editorial page. What are your responsibilities as deputy editor?
I work very closely with the editorial page editor, Gail Collins, and with a large and wonderful editorial board to come up with the opinions of the New York Times 7 days a week, every day of the year. And that's a process that involves a lot of discussion and debate. The writing of editorials, editing of editorials. It's a big responsibility for the paper that dates back to the beginnings of American journalism and really back through British journalistic history. The notion that a newspaper would have an editorial voice, we believe it's an important function at the New York Times, and we devote a lot of resources and energy to trying to produce an interesting and provocative and principled editorial page.
The New York Times editorials have been opposed to the Bush administration's push for war now with Iraq. And I'm wondering if you take any heat from the administration because of that. I guess particularly I'm wondering if any reporters from the Times find that certain access to the White House is withheld in punishment or in criticism of the editorial page stand. Because that's a fear that a lot of people have. Is it actually a reality?
I don't think it's a reality in Washington. The custom of having editorials, even ones that are in disagreement, is so well established in the United States that occasionally in some administrations that are particularly paranoid, I'm thinking of the Nixon administration and if you go back to the Johnson administration during Vietnam, there are efforts at retaliation through cutting people off or, you know, even worse during the Nixon years when they created an enemies list and bugged people's telephones. The Bush administration seems to be fairly enlightened, I would say, in this respect. They take our opinions and the opinions of others seriously, as far as I can tell. I don't think they're adjusting their policies based on the New York Times editorial page, but I don't sense that they're in a bunker mentality. That's one of the things I've noticed about this administration. However much one might disagree with its policies, they have not fallen into that kind of siege mentality that was so damaging to the Nixon White House.
What editorial do you think had the biggest impact?
Well, it's interesting. If you think back over the time I've been at the editorial page, which is now coming up on 9 years, I think a lot of the foreign pieces on foreign countries have a huge impact. It's as if the megaphone of the New York Times editorial page somehow is amplified when you move out of Washington and New York and other places. And I think that's not surprising considering the number of editorial voices that there are here in the United States. But if we write a piece, for example, criticizing a new press law in Argentina, as we did a number of years ago, the next day the law was reversed. And I think that that's partly a function of the respect that the paper carries. It's also a confusion, I think, in foreign capitals that when the New York Times editorializes, it's somehow speaking on behalf of the American government, which we are most certainly not doing.
What editorial about war with Iraq has had the biggest impact?
I think the piece that we ran quite recently, the headline was Say No to War. And it was our bottom line articulation that as long as the Security Council is in opposition to a war, which it has been of late, that the United States should not go to war with this kind of ad hoc coalition that it has mustered, including Britain, and Britain being the only country with real military forces to contribute, that really what's most important to us at this point is how the United States manages its power in the world. And yes, we understand that Iraq is a threat, but we don't believe that Iraq is a mortal threat and an immediate threat to American interests. And we think the paramount issue in the years ahead is how this hyper mega power known as the United States manages itself in world affairs, and that it not rush off arrogantly doing things and leaving the rest of the world in resentment.
So you say that got the biggest response. What was the response?
Enormous response. I think a lot of positive response from readers. There's a lot of anti-war sentiment in the country. And I think we sort of articulated it in a way that was reasonable and commonsensical and was not ideological. We don't write the page from an ideological position that we're Democrats or Republicans or we're anti-war. We try to look at every issue based on the merits. And in this case, I think we laid down an editorial that basically made a lot of sense to a lot of people.
Has there been a lot of disagreement within the editorial page staff about what your stand should be on the possible war with Iraq?
We've had a lot of good discussions about it. We don't, as a habit, tend to talk in detail about the discussions of the board because it would probably inhibit us if we did. But what I can say is that we've discussed it an enormous amount in recent months. And a lot of different views have been expressed. So I found it, as someone who's covered these issues for many years, I found it exceedingly difficult to arrive at my own opinion about Iraq, because I think it is a complex issue. And I think the board, editorial board of the Times, also struggled over the months to figure out exactly how we felt about this.
Could you describe how you did arrive at your own opinion? You said it was difficult to do that.
It was difficult because I take the Iraq threat very seriously, and particularly in the wake of 9/11. To me, the great danger is that Iraq would develop nuclear weapons. I'm concerned about their chemical and biological weapons, but I'm particularly concerned that they would develop nuclear weapons. And even though there's no history of cooperation between Saddam Hussein and terror groups like Al-Qaeda, and I discount to some extent what the administration has presented as intelligence on that issue. I don't think it's persuasive. But I don't rule out the possibility that at some time in the future an alliance might develop, and I think the United States has to be mindful of that. But given the potential consequences of a war, everything from the bloodshed and devastation of the military actions themselves out through what could be an incredibly complicated and difficult period of trying to govern and reconstruct Iraq and to hold it together and to create a democratic society there, which is what President Bush says he wants to do, all of that would just be exceedingly difficult under the best of circumstances. And to try to do it without the support of the Security Council just seems to me to be a bad policy.
My guest is Philip Taubman, deputy editorial page editor of the New York Times and author of the new book, Secret Empire, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Hidden Story of America's Space Espionage. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Philip Taubman, author of the new book, Secret Empire. He's the deputy editorial page editor of the New York Times. When we left off, we were talking about how he arrived at his opinion that although Iraq does present a threat, we should not rush to war without the support of the Security Council. You said that you didn't find persuasive the intelligence that the United States government has offered that Iraq has ties with al-Qaeda. You covered intelligence for a long time. What is it that you find less than persuasive?
What I find troubling in this case is that we're basically looking at what in a court of law would be called circumstantial evidence. There's evidence that an al-Qaeda leader went to Baghdad and received medical care there. There's apparently evidence that a number of al-Qaeda operatives, a dozen or so, found their way to Baghdad after 9/11 and may have operated out of the Iraqi capital for a while. There's the assertion that there's a al-Qaeda camp in northern Iraq, which, interestingly, is a part of Iraq that's not in Iraqi control. So the accusation that this is a camp that shows that Iraq is allied with al-Qaeda doesn't quite make the case because it's in a part of Iraq where there isn't Iraqi control. But what's missing is the kind of hard intelligence that Secretary of State Powell presented to the Security Council about other issues involving Iraq, where there were intercepts of communications that showed convincingly, I thought, that the Iraqis were working overtime to try to cover up their weapons programs. There was photographic intelligence, satellite intelligence, showing that various sites around Iraq had been cleaned up before inspectors got there. That's the kind of hard intelligence that leaves no doubt in my mind that the Iraqis have unconventional weapons programs and that they're trying to disguise and hide those. But when it comes to the Iraqi connection with al-Qaeda, it's much more amorphous.
If you believe that there is good intelligence telling us that the Iraqis are working on weapons of mass destruction and that they're being deceitful to the weapons inspectors, why do you then not support the president's push to war?
Well, our position on the editorial page was that there was a middle ground, which is essentially to upgrade the inspection force. I understand that Saddam Hussein is not in compliance with the United Nations Security Council. I think the editorial page understands that he has not made the about-face that would be necessary in which he would fully cooperate and disarm voluntarily. However, we think that we now have him in a position where with the present inspection force and the strengthening of it, and I mean by strengthening, putting in hundreds of more inspectors, and by having unfettered overflights of Iraq with intelligence gathering systems like the U-2, that we basically have him so off balance that whatever programs he has are essentially stalled at the moment, and that he certainly is not in a position to turn those programs into the kind of offensive firepower that would threaten his neighbors or other countries. And that kind of solution, which I think he would have to accept now, would give us the kind of security that we need without having to go to war. And it would also allow us to bring home a good portion of the troops that we have out there. I don't buy the argument that just because we have 300,000 troops in the region now, we have to go to war, because to bring them home would be an admission of failure. I think you could sustain a very intrusive, smothering kind of inspection regime by maintaining 100,000 troops in the region, or maybe 50 to 100,000, and plenty of air power to back them up if you needed them. So this notion that we have to go to war now because we'll be humiliated if we don't is the worst possible argument to go to war.
As someone who wrote about intelligence and national security issues for 20 years, I'm wondering how interested you are in how people perceive United States spying. For instance, I think it's fair to say that America internally is pretty divided about America's approach to spying, and some people think that we spend far too much money on it and America is far too involved in espionage, and other people think that that's the only reason why we're a free country is because we've invested so much in that part of our security. Do you see a lot of kind of extremes, and I wonder if you feel you've taken a kind of middle path yourself, you know, that you believe in it, but you also believe that there are certain extremes that we should be wary of? Because that's the impression I get reading your book, that you're...
Yes, I believe that intelligence is vital. It's absolutely crucial, as we discovered on 9/11. And a country that does not have effective means of gathering intelligence is a country that's vulnerable to attack constantly. So it's absolutely critical that the United States invest significant amounts of money in its intelligence gathering agencies, and that it try to constantly be inventing new technologies and recruiting and training new agents and doing all that it can. It was really crucial to stabilizing the Cold War, and it can be crucial to defending the United States from terrorist attacks. The trouble is that, like all these gigantic government agencies, intelligence agencies have a tendency to waste money. They have a tendency to be badly managed, and occasionally they have a tendency to essentially get out of control, which is what happened to the CIA in the 1960s when it went off. Mind you, not on its own entirely. It had the authority of the president to do a lot of these things, but all the assassination plots and famous boneheaded operations that were revealed in the 1970s. So you have to be careful of that. You also have to be careful, and I think this is particularly important today, that these agencies and their powerful intelligence gathering systems are not turned on American citizens. That is the quickest and surest way to rob Americans of their democratic rights and their civil liberties. These systems are incredibly powerful. They can pluck off phone, cell phone, fax communications, you name it, email communications. We just have to be very careful as we combat terrorism that we control how we use these systems internally, because it's not much tweaking that would be required to turn them on the Americans and to move us towards the creation of the kind of police state that I lived in the Soviet Union as a correspondent for 4 years. And believe me, that is not a place where any American would want to live.
Philip Taubman, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Philip Taubman is deputy editorial page editor of the New York Times. His new book is called Secret Empire, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Hidden Story of America's Space Espionage. Coming up, Ed Ward on the early days of the alternative music scene in Austin, Texas, where the South by Southwest Music Conference is now underway. This is Fresh Air. Do-it-yourself aesthetic caused an explosion of local music scenes at the end of the 70s. Austin, which had always been a hotbed of musical activity, was no exception. And this week in Austin, the largest music conference in the country, South by Southwest, is underway. Rock historian Ed Ward is going to revisit the Austin of the late 70s.
The In the late summer of 1979, I was asked to interview for a job as the rock critic at Austin, Texas daily newspaper, The American Statesman. My friend Jonick Petoskey had alerted me to the job and picked me up at the airport when I arrived. Before I'd even settled down in the front seat, he slammed a cassette into his player. His girlfriend Chris was playing in a band with the vocalist who called himself Joe King Carrasco, but who was really Joe Teutsch from Dumas, Texas. He'd recorded Mezcal Road with a band he called El Molino, but now he had a more stable band of Austinites with Chris on keyboards. I told Joe Nick I'd love to hear them, and he assured me I would. First, though, there was the matter of getting the job, which I did, and then I had to move to Texas. The paper lost no time putting me to work, and on Halloween, I went to Palmer Auditorium to review my first show, The Police, with an awful band called Fashion, and, as per their contract, a local band.
There's something artificial about the style of your smile, the face of a woman but the screams of a child. I see you every night in a different club. There's something very wrong about the way that you love me. I'm not the kind of guy who cares about those things.
The Skunks were one of Austin's first punk bands, although in retrospect they were really more of a hard rock band. And I could see they had a following, since there was a girl dressed up in a skunk suit dancing while they played. But they were only part of the scene swirling around Raoul's, a beer bar near the University of Texas campus where, presided over by the gentle but firm hand of Joseph Gonzalez, weird bands and weird audiences were gathering, despite harassment from frat boys and other creeps. Raoul's had been going for over a year by the time I got there, and had already made headlines in Austin when the Huns, another legendary early punk band, had caused a riot. The police had come in response to a noise complaint, and the Huns' singer, Phil Tolstead, kissed the cop who went on stage to announce the place closed. A number of people, including the editor of the campus newspaper, wound up in jail, and punk had officially arrived in Austin. The Skunks were a trio, led by bassist Jesse Sublett, with a wonderfully aggressive guitarist John D. Graham, and Billy Blackman on drums. Because of their mainstream appeal, though, and the fact that the local rock station played them, they were deemed uncool by many. And then there was Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns, who appealed to the old-time Austin crowd that loved Doug Somm. They were melodic, catchy, and visual. Joe had learned the old blues trick of having a 20-foot cord on his guitar and would run through the audience and sometimes out of the club while he was playing. After an early single sponsored by Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, the band signed to Stiff Records in London and went on one of the notorious Stiff tours.
Wait.
The most intriguing band was one without any ties to Texas past, it seemed. They called themselves Standing Waves. Blessed or cursed with three songwriters, they were well-versed in bands like XTC and Talking Heads, yet came out of it with something that was their own. They were the intellectuals' favorites, the anti-skunks, and a furious war of words went on between the two camps. But Austin's a funny place, as I would learn. Excellent bands arise there all the time, but they rarely translate local success to anything more than regional fame. Austin was visited by the record companies in the new wave signing frenzy of the late 70s, but only a mediocrity called D-Day got to make one long-forgotten album. One by one, the early bands disappeared. The Huns, Terminal Mind, The Next, and then the Survivors did too. Jesse Sublett tried another lineup with the Skunks and then chose the literary life, which he still pursues. Standing Waves also regrouped and moved to New York, but that didn't last long, and today the ex-members run a folk art gallery, present the news on San Antonio television, and work in a bookstore, among other things. Joe King Carrasco became a fraternity and spring break favorite and has continued with many changes of band members. Joe, Nick, and Chris married, and so did Jesse and Lois, the girl in the skunk suit, and the Austin music scene entered the 80s.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
I want to play like children, all I want to do is play. I want to play like children, but now becomes yesterday.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Franklin Flyer, a novel from Nicholas Christopher, the author of A Trip to the Stars. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Leslie Gore was one of Quincy Jones' first discoveries. On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate Quincy Jones' 70th birthday with an interview in which he discusses his life and his work with Gore, Michael Jackson, Lionel Hampton, Ray Charles, and others. Join us for the next Fresh Air.